I've been involved in this alumni network, not directly, but I've always sought help from them since high school. When I was first introduced to finance at CLSA, I think I was a freshman in college. I reached out to some St. Mary's finance alumni who kindly started passing my resume around, and then it got dropped in the hands of the head of Japan at CLSA at the time, and he reached out to me saying, "Hey, why do you want to come intern for us?" So that was very surprising. But at the end of the day, you get to now that's when I sort of realized how important and how valuable the alumni, St. Mary's alumni network was.
Welcome to the season 7 premiere of Tokyo Alumni Podcast. On episode 61 today, we have our second youngest guest yet. He graduated St. Mary's in 2017 after attending there for his K-12 education and is currently studying government and legal studies at Bowdoin College, where he is expected to graduate this spring. Upon graduation, he will begin working at Goldman Sachs as an analyst in their merchant banking division in Tokyo. He most recently worked at Jefferies as a part-time equity research associate covering TMT, as well as interning for Goldman Sachs last summer. Prior to working in finance, he founded a food tech startup and had held various internship positions at Safety Architects, Trip.com, and the Keirendan, the U.S.-Japan Business Council. Up until college, he alpine ski raced competitively, representing Japan at the international level. At St. Mary's, he was part of the cross-country, soccer, and Buccaneer swim teams. He also sang for the varsity ensemble. Welcome to the podcast, Tokyo.
Great to be here. Thanks so much.
So our second youngest guest yet, I'm really interested to talk to, how COVID-19 is affecting young people, as well as, your experience in regards to, more recently selecting college. Something that's really stuck with me recently was I was talking to a mother who sent her kids to multiple international schools, and she was telling me how one thing to be careful about with alumni is schools change so much, right, every 10, 20 years. So we have sort of these biased perspectives. So I think it's really important to get someone like you and, others in the future on this podcast too that are also more recent in regards to their experience of international schools. But first, can you just tell us a bit about yourself? What are you up to? And
So I was born and raised in Tokyo, Japan. I've been there until 2017. And then in 2017, I joined Bowdoin up in Maine. It's a small liberal arts college, comprises about 500 students per grade. And I'm on my last semester. I'm ready to graduate in the spring and then joining Goldman back in Japan. I'm super excited. And I'm so happy to be on this podcast, and I'm very happy that Nick invited me.
Yeah, we're happy to have you. And off air, we were just talking a bit about COVID-19. And I think we could just jump right into that because I think it's a big thing, on everyone's mind. COVID-19 as a, almost graduating senior, what's going on in regards to your classmates? How is it hitting the job market in regards to, you guys that are graduating this spring? What is the outlook like right now? And what are, current college juniors and seniors talking about?
Yeah, no, I definitely think, and as I mentioned to Nick earlier, that the finance industry definitely has fared better than most other industries. We got lucky in this COVID situation, unlike 2008, that Nick was unfortunately a part of. Classmates have definitely struggled finding full-time positions. I've been trying to, in a sense, help connect alumni to these students. And also, it's unfortunate because a lot of my classmates have steered away from industries that they're truly passionate about. For instance, one of my friend, I don't want to name him here, but he was very interested in the sports industry. And obviously the sport industry was badly hit during COVID. So now he's taken a 180 turn and started looking into trade companies and consulting, something I'm sure that he never imagined himself doing. So that's one of the, I think, consequences I've seen that COVID has caused for definitely the undergraduate level. But that being said, it has become very competitive. It always was competitive to go into the job market, I think, here throughout the world. And it only has become more competitive, right? I interned at Goldman during the summer, and I was very fortunate enough to get the full-time offer. So I didn't really have to go scrambling to find a job again. But that being said, the alumni network has definitely, I've seen it, been very strong and helpful to students that recently graduated, are going to graduate this spring.
Interesting. So you, when you say alumni network, you're referring to the St. Mary's International School Alumni Network. Can you tell me specifically what type of networking systems St. Mary's provides for its alumni?
I've been involved in this alumni network, not directly, but I've always sought help from them since high school. When I was first introduced to finance at CLSA, I think I was a freshman in college, I reached out to some St. Mary's finance alumni who kindly started passing my resume around, and then it got dropped in the hands of the head of Japan at CLSA at the time. And he reached out to me saying, hey, why do you want to come intern for us? So that was very surprising. But at the end of the day, you get to, that's when I sort of realized how important and how valuable the alumni, St. Mary's Alumni Network was. You don't really need to know people very personally. You could just reach out to them via Facebook, via LinkedIn, via email, telling them what you're passionate about. And these guys are there to seriously just help. I think they've been helped by their senpai, and there's a culture of passing that sort of ritual down. So I think in a sense, I'm expected to help my kohai out as well. But also whenever you go out to dinner, there's always a saying how, if you're going out to dinner with a kohai, that he never pays, right? Like the senpai always pays. And that's in a sense, to pass that ritual down. It's not just about the person, the people there in that immediate moment. Yeah.
That's a great point, that reach out, right? I feel like a lot of, especially college students, forget that networking is just so, so important, especially with the international school community.
The network, alumni network, is definitely important. And I think a lot of people don't really realize the value of it until much later on in their, college life, right? I've seen students go scramble through the alum, scrambling into the alumni network list and trying to find someone they could reach out to when they're a senior in college. Whereas I think there's a lot of value in just starting to get to know these people and what they do, and starting to reach out to people in several industries, not just one that you may be really excited about, but something that I did was, do something completely different in tech, right? In tech marketing at Trip.com. And that was through a St. Mary's alumni. It opens your mind up, I think, a bit to what other jobs entail. But also, you get to know these people at such a young age. The person I contacted was probably up in his 40s, 50s, right? If it wasn't for the alumni network, I probably wouldn't know him. And also, I wouldn't really think to reach out to him or talk to him. But it has always ended up very beneficial to me.
That's really cool. It's definitely, I think, something a lot of other schools are working on. But it seems like St. Mary's has, one of the most robust and sort of active networking, which I think definitely other schools have the chance to emulate. And, as a current educator myself, beyond my own alumnus, my school right here, it's a newer school. So I see what, St. Mary's does. And I definitely, hope we can emulate that type of, robust and, active networking. And you mentioned earlier about tech startups. I was wondering, you kind of have a variety of experience, especially for a really young guy. with your time in Jefferies, Goldman, and the tech startups. I was a bit curious about when you say food tech startups, can you elaborate on that point a bit more?
So when I was in college, I think it was my sophomore year, I remember going, so I was actually in Cambridge, Massachusetts at the time. And I was out dining at a Vietnamese restaurant. And I hated how long the waiters took to, you know, give me the menu, to serve me, to give me the check. So it came to a point where I was like, is there something I could do about it, right? Is there something, expedite the process? So I created an app where you could virtually line up, virtually browse the menu, virtually order. And once your food was ready or near ready, it would invite you to the restaurant and ask you to come over. And at the time, I thought it was this great idea. People will love it, especially in a country like Japan, right? Where people don't necessarily, especially during lunchtime, people don't go out to eat with a partner. They usually just go out to eat alone. Seeing that, I was like, okay, maybe they could spend their time elsewhere, not in line, not wasting their time in the restaurant, maybe at a cafe, maybe continue doing work, right? So I thought it was this great app. I started pushing it around to different restaurants, asking people to beta test it for me. And the appetite wasn't there during 2019, right? The appetite was definitely not there. I think one thing I realized was it's very hard to persuade Japanese restaurants in adopting a system and a model that hasn't been proven yet. And thus, it was much harder to get investors interested in my app as well. And obviously I was, you know, very inexperienced. I had this big passion to launch this app that I thought was great, but started dying down. And sooner or later, I realized I probably should go back to college and concentrate on my work. So I did that. But no, I think what is unfortunate is that if I had launched it maybe sometime right before COVID hit, might have been a more popular app, but timing is everything, definitely for startups.
That's pretty interesting that you've been able to have that experience already, even before you're joining the workforce. And, you know, speaking of the workforce, so, you know, you're in finance, and I'm interested why that route. You said you, as early as freshman year, right, you developed the interest and you reached out. So what sort of pursued you towards that direction?
Yeah, so I think finance is definitely a very broad industry. A lot of people think finance equals the stock market, you know, equals investment banking. And it, definitely that was the lure initially for me, right? I saw these black, red, green tickers and lights flashing on the TV as a high school student. And I was always watching The Big Short and, you know, all these, the Wall Street with Leonardo. Yeah, Wolf of Wall Street. And, you know, watching those, it puts you in a very toxic, I think, mindset. But at the same time, like, it was an industry I could somewhat see myself in. I thought it would be cool initially, right, to be a banker or be in the stock market. So which is why I reached out for an internship. But I started to realize during the couple of, I guess, the past 2-3 years that I've interned at financial firms is that, you know, it's such a broad industry and there's so many different things to do in finance, which is why I've sort of steered away from your usual stock markets and sort of public markets into more of the private markets, which is what I'll be doing at Goldman, is an investing in promising companies, real estate, as well as credit. So I'm probably speaking jargon right now, but I think there's a lot of misinformation passed around that finance is this glamorous thing where everyone's making money. I've realized that that's not the thing. I'm not going to be the Wolf of Wall Street next year, sadly, but I can only see myself here in this industry for now, at least. And to explain why I got into sort of investing and why I was interested in being on sort of the buy side of finance was because when I actually did this startup, I was talking to investors, right? And every time they would either sell my product or, sorry, am I allowed to swear in this podcast?
Yeah, that's fine, yeah.
Or, you know, turn my stuff down, and it sucked. It like definitely sucked. But like, I realized that there was another job on the other side, being that guy sitting on the other side, being able to browse all these different companies and products, and being the deciding factor, the guy who decides what to put someone's money in, right? And I thought that was quite interesting, which is why I started looking for an investing role. Less sort of the your typical research analyst or trader role.
That's interesting. And I think a lot of students, and we talked about this a bit off air too, about internships, is it just seems to be an increasing, you know, ever increasing necessity to enter the job market, right? 20, 30 years ago, I can think of a lot of people who got pretty prestigious jobs right out of college without any internship. Now it seems like it's almost the norm, definitely junior year, very likely sophomore year. So when it came to getting that internship at Goldman, what do you think helped you get that position apart from the St. Mary's alumni networking?
I come from a very, I think, non-traditional background and in a non-target school. Liberal arts colleges don't offer business programs, finance classes. So I was at a disadvantage there. Whenever I got asked a very technical question at interviews, it was very hard to answer those for sure, right? But what really helped me, I think, stand out was my resume, was my background that I've touched explored various industries. I've done, you know, everything from architecture to finance, right? Like, and in between, like startups, tech. And I didn't just do them because I thought it was good for my resume. I also was actually quite curious where I could see myself maybe 5 years down the line. And having that story, I think definitely helped me, I guess, secure my position at GS.
You mentioned, you know, technical questions, and this is sort of very much a personal question of mine, but something I'm very curious in, you know, when you talk to guys in consulting, I don't know if they've ever told you stories about, they ask you those technical questions about how many tennis balls, you know, fit in an airplane. Yeah, yeah. I'm sure you've heard of that, or how many Starbucks are in Tokyo. And I remember before interviews, people told me that. And then sure enough, I did get like one of those questions. So if someone was to, you know, a few years younger than you, interview for Goldman Sachs, what are one or two questions they should be careful of and aware that might, you know, they might not be ready for?
I think it also, it depends where you're interviewing for. I think Japan, if this person is going to return to Japan, it's less to the technical questions. I think it's more your story, right? It's what kind of interesting story and what makes you stand out from the other candidates. Obviously, if you're in this international community, having English is a plus. But also, I think having Japanese is a great plus as well. And I think a lot of people tend to forget that, especially during high school. People don't really concentrate on their Japanese. But one thing I do regret not working on a bit harder when I was in high school was my Japanese. Because I think at the end of the day, if you do want to return to Japan and work in Japanese culture and in a Japanese company, you need to be able to speak Japanese, read and write especially. So that's something that I'm still working on. I'm still struggling through. But having the story there is like the most important. But for, I hear from American interviews, and I've done some myself, they're definitely technical heavy. And I think the one you pointed out, how many balls fit in a 747 Boeing airplane, is an important one to remember.
It seems like it has become so mainstream, though. Everyone is ready now for that one. So we'll see sort of whether these companies diversify their you know, set of questions. It seems like they all pull out of the same pool of questions, but that's really interesting. When it comes to, you know, Goldman, and you mentioned using Japanese at the Tokyo company, this is a theme that consistently comes about, you know, of course, multiculturalism, but also multilingual, you know, or I guess for most of us, bilingual, because it's hard to be, you know, beyond that. you are saying you are still working on your Japanese. I'm curious, how do you pursue your Japanese learning as a college student at an American university?
I think an important way, I mean, I think a good way to learn Japanese and a business level of Japanese is reading the news, really understanding what they're saying. I still struggle, you know, I subscribe to a couple of Japanese articles like the Bloomberg Japan news feed, and they send in some stuff. And, you know, what's been helpful is to just read it on your computer, because when you don't know a word, you could just kind of click on it to see what it means and what it says, right? And memorizing those words, I think, quite important, because at the end of the day, like, these Bloomberg and business articles are quite sometimes technical, and words that you probably will come across in your job, right? Whether that's finance, consulting, tech, at some point, you're probably going to come across these kanji and words, right? So those are definitely important. And that was, I think, a key way for me to learn. And I'm still using that technique to learn my Japanese.
Yeah, that's really good to hear, like, how everyone is always learning, because that seems to be the story, especially with Japanese, because it's just such a, it's a difficult language, right? And I feel like I'm still learning, you know, in my 30s.
I mean, I think the other thing is, like, writing a Japanese email is something that we probably never touch or do as an international student. And I think learning how to do that is quite important, especially if you do want to work in Japan. Obviously, if you want to end up in the States or in Singapore, Hong Kong, maybe it's less essential. But I've heard, like, Singapore offices, like, are looking for people that are fluent in Japanese, because probably they still, you know, curate to Japanese clients too, right? Sorry, I'm talking finance specific now, but that's something I think to learn is Japanese emails.
That's a great point, that especially when it comes to sort of your human capital, right, your value on the market. It seems like being in the States, speaking Japanese, the value is not as much there. Whereas if you're in Japan and you could speak Japanese well and speak English, or Singapore and, you know, you can speak Japanese, it seems like there are certain markets where you can really sort of fully sort of utilize that value of being bicultural and bilingual.
Yeah, for sure. And I think the Japanese market for jobs and undergraduate, at the undergraduate level, is less, definitely less competitive than the American job market, right? Because especially, let's say, in finance, because these people are looking for bilingual speakers. And that's an advantage for us, I think, international students, is that we've been taught how to speak, read, and write English really well. But at the end of the day, if you join these Japanese companies, like, your bosses are sometimes going to be American people, sometimes going to be, you know, British or Chinese, but most of the time it's going to be a Japanese person who's going to be managing you, right? And these guys are not going to, you know, waza waza speak English for you just because you suck at Japanese. Like, you're probably going to have to be able to speak Japanese at their level to make sure that you get that bonus as well.
Yeah. Right? That's a great point. Yeah, that learning Japanese is so important. And definitely that's such a, like, Gen Z thing too, that you were saying earlier about being able to click on the word and look at that definition, right? It's really only something that, you know, we've been able to do the last 4 or 5 years. You're talking about, like, the automatic, right, detection, not like copy and paste into Google and just literally highlight it. Interesting. And, you know, you're about to graduate a liberal arts school. And this is something I have not quite come to terms with, and it might be interesting talking to you about this, is sort of that big school versus liberal arts. You know, I teach at a private school myself, an international private school, and it's in Korea, and there's definitely students who are very torn in regards to whether or not you go to sort of the name brand big school, you know, your UCLA's, to a certain degree, you know, NYU, you know, and then of course most of the Ivy Leagues, or there's now these, you know, elite liberal arts schools like Harvey Mudd, you know, Bodo and Wellesley. I always mess it up. It's called Wellesley, right? Wellesley and Wesleyan. They're both good. Yeah, liberal arts schools. So when you were graduating high school, I imagine they were both on the table, right? Those bigger schools, UCLA, Stanford. And what pushed you towards liberal arts? And do you feel like, obviously hindsight's 2020, but has your experience so far, do you feel like you made the right decision going to a small school?
So yeah, no, I definitely was torn whether to go to a school that had a name and whether to go to a school that was obviously highly reputable, but not very well known. And I chose Bowdoin, but both my parents actually went to NYU, and they told me all about, you know, growing up, they've always told me they loved NYU, et cetera, that, you know, it's a great city that, you know, if you love Tokyo, you're gonna love New York. But me, myself, I was also, you know, as I think wrote in my bio, that I was a competitive ski racer. And I've always loved the mountains. At some point in high school, I was about to transition to go to boarding school just primarily to really focus on my skiing. Eventually, it came down to where, first of all, I think where I was accepted. Everyone usually has this like 13, you know, names. long school list, right, of where they want to go. But at the end of the day, you probably only get accepted unless you're like intelligent, this like ultra wanted person, that you probably only get accepted to like about half. And that's your choice, right? And from my choices that I had, definitely Bowdoin was a very, very top school. But also, you know, it came to a point where I was like, okay, you know, I could go to these name schools, but at the same time, maybe I should get out in a comfort zone. I've always been comfortable at St. Mary's, right? I'm Japanese, I'm Asian, you know, probably, you know, at least I'm not like those international kids who come from some other country that may feel out of place in a sense, right? So I felt always comfortable and I always wanted to kind of step out of that comfort zone, and which is why I think I chose Bowdoin at the end. Have I felt satisfied? I think yes and no. The experience itself has definitely made me grow into a different person. I think I've been more Americanized, being surrounded by like 90% American students, right? That's definitely changed my attitude and also my personality a bit, I think. But at the same time, it's made me aware of what like true America was. If I went to like NYU, I probably would have hung out with, you know, all my international friends, which are all, you know, very amazing. You know, I get along with, I have a great time with, and I always want to return to them. But Bowdoin in that sense has taught me something I would not have taught myself otherwise. So that comes with cost and benefit, like, you know, pros and cons, right? Like I had times where I was not happy, but I was also times where I'm like looking back at my life, I'm like, that was the right choice. So yeah, I think it's a really give and take.
That's interesting too, the sort of the juxtaposition of New York versus to confirm, I was Googling it. It's your school's located in Maine, right? Yeah. Like a Bernie Sanders style Maine. It's very much as far as you could pretty much get from the city. Wow. And as you were mentioning with demographic too, I just read there's only about 100 international school students. So just a few dozen of you guys per grade. So that's a great point, that sort of purposefully placing yourself in a place that might be out of your comfort zone. And yeah, and I guess as you were saying too, a lot of it is yes and no, right? It seems like there's almost never, but yeah, it's definitely an interesting thing for international schools because people forget, I think sometimes how competitive these liberal arts schools are. I was looking at the, you know, acceptance rate for Bowdoin, for example, is 9% in comparison to like UCLA is like 12. So, you know, it's a lower, you know, more competitive than UCLA, which, you know, most people would consider top, you know, tier. So in regards to job hunting, that was the other point.
It wasn't as competitive when I was, it was like 14%. In fairness,
well, you're being modest, but it's basically competitive. it's in that tier where it's very competitive. This is the other point, though, and I often talk about this with my seniors because I teach mostly juniors and seniors, is name value. So one thing that I've been concerned about with a lot of my students, especially my AP students who go on to the liberal arts schools, is I'm worried that when they look for jobs, especially outside of the States or outside of that area. Like in California, you know, if you go to the South, people know the Claremont McKenna schools. But then when you go to the East Coast, maybe not so much, Japan, not so much. So did you ever feel like it was difficult to in the job market when you didn't have people who were knowledgeable about the college system and maybe weren't aware of how the liberal arts school systems work in the States?
Yeah, no, I definitely understand that feeling of fear, right? Of when, especially when you start working, is are people going to recognize your school as a, you know, a pretty reputable, good school? And luckily for me, when I first started, the guy who hired me did know my school. He had a friend who attended. I think I come from a perspective where obviously when I interviewed for, let's say, Jefferies or Goldman, I had somewhat of a history on my resume that I was quite passionate about just kind of exploring industries, right? And I think that definitely helped me. If I didn't have that, it probably would have been a bit harder. Like people still definitely have a tough time, even when they know the school really well, pronounce the school, right? Mm-hmm. A lot of people think it's Bowdoin or Bowdoin. I always don't correct them, but you know, it definitely puts a dent in your pride complex, right? It's like, I worked for this, but yet my name doesn't stand up to Harvard, Stanford, UCLA, NYU, whatever it is, like these big name schools, right? But you know, as you grow, I think older in a sense, as a college student, you forget that this fear, and it actually only drove me more to, you know, make sure that things were on my resume when I was going to interview at a big company. So I definitely do think that it's important to have the name value. It's especially when you return to Japan, because a lot of Japanese people don't know American liberal arts colleges, especially, right? But in the States, most people do know, but still, you still have some people that don't know it. So it's really what you make of it, I think. But also, like, would you go to, I know, like a top 40 school at a big national university compared to a top five liberal arts college, right? That's also another thing to weigh, right? What were you accepted to in between the two? Those are, I think, my thoughts on that question.
That's interesting. I actually recall now, I was quickly Googling. I don't know if you listen to Malcolm Gladwell's podcast, Revisionist History. He mentions Bowdoin spends, I said Bowdoin myself right now. It's Bowdoin, right? Bowdoin. It looks like Bowdoin. How Bowdoin, he compares Bowdoin and Vassar's food. And he mentions how the food is really bad at Bowdoin. And his theory is that it's because Bowdoin spends more money on financial aid. So they have less sort of resource to put towards the cafeteria. Yeah. So I was just wondering, does Gladwell have a point?
No, I think food is great at Bowdoin. If you look at the college dining ranks, not that they matter too much, but they're pretty high up there. I've seen them in the top at least five, but it's partly because they serve lobster, mussels, local grass-fed chicken. So I would say the food's pretty good. I think they spend quite a bit of money on it as well.
Yeah. So I don't know. Maybe Gladwell's assertion is based on just a comparative study to the other liberal arts, but I don't know. I can tell you at Berkeley, we definitely did not have lobsters. Very different.
Lobsters. We have this lobster fest at the start of the year, which is really fun.
That's pretty good to hear. So maybe Gladwell is wrong. I wanted to talk to someone firsthand. It was nice to have that opportunity. It's called Food Fight, by the way, for anyone who's listening. It's a podcast by Gladwell. Yeah, it's a very interesting one. Yeah, and he specifically brings up your college. And as you were mentioning earlier about, you know, alpine skiing, very serious athlete in representing the country. So can you tell us a bit about, you know, you and alpine skiing, and, you know, what at what point did you basically decide to sort of give it up as well? Because it seems like at one point you were representing the country, said you might even go to boarding school for alpine skiing. So, you know, how did that all come about? And, you know, at what point did you sort of push that away to focus more on studies?
Yeah, no, I do want to say that, like, you know, when I say I was representing the country, it was at the sort of the junior level where, you know, I got to travel around the world with a lot of, I guess, still students who were top in the alpine ski, I guess, field. And we went all over, you know, the country, Europe, and Austria, just everywhere. And I think something that really stuck with me with skiing was that it really made me risk adverse type of guy who, like, I have to go down the hill not really caring what's going to happen next. Right? I could end up in a bloodbath. I could end up with a few broken legs, which I have, you know. So, like, it's taught me to be very much risk-taking type of person. But what drove me, it was a very serious sport. I've done it since I was about 2 years old. I think my mom mentioned that I tried to start skiing before I could start walking. And because it actually stemmed from me wanting to go on the chairlift. I was dying to go on the chairlift, not skiing, right? it was very serious. And up until maybe, you know, ninth grade, eighth grade, where my grades started falling. You know, I was pretty much failing classes. It came to a point where I was like, okay, what am I going to do? Am I going to concentrate on skiing or not? Obviously I kind of saw myself as a working man. I wanted to work. Yeah. I decided that, you know, boarding school with my parents, obviously decided that boarding school wasn't for me, that maybe I should stay at St. Mary's, which really paid off. I'm very privileged and fortunate to be there, but yeah, it was a hard decision. I think a lot of people want, and I know you've interviewed and done a podcast with the Ortiz brothers, who I know quite well. And they continued pursuing sport, right? And like, they have a career, which is another option. But for me at that time, as an ignorant high schooler, I decided that I wanted to study and bring my grades up, end up in a decent college, and start working.
Yeah, it's funny. As you were talking, I was just thinking about the Ortiz brothers as well. And it just seems like it's a real double-edged sword, right? To pursue, even at the collegiate level. I played myself for 2 years, albeit it was Division III. And, you know, I'll never regret those 2 years. But at the same time, it is a commitment. And sometimes I worry, especially with some of these international schools, there might be an over-focus in regards to playing sports in college. Because, like, at the end of the day, it's about passion. And unless you're really passionate about it, it's like, it might not be worth that, you know, 20-hour commitment a week. You know, because this is the Tokyo Alumni Podcast, can I ask you, what are your most fond memories of St. Mary's International School? And how has it made you the person you are today?
Fond memories, like really bad ones. I'm kidding.
Or bad memories. That is going to make good content.
Yeah. I think one of my most fond memories, it was my junior year. Obviously I was passionate about skiing. Right. And I kind of wanted my friends to be passionate about it too. Right. So I organized this big junior ski trip. Where we took everyone, like maybe 80 students, I didn't think 80 came, like maybe 70 students go to Nagano and ski at a ski resort who I knew the owner very well. We got things organized through him. And we took everyone skiing, right? And that was one of the more entrepreneurial things I did as a high schooler, was organizing this big junior ski trip. And apparently the legacy was kept for about 2 years, right? Until some people kind of messed up. buying alcohol at the vending machines in the onsen or whatever. But apparently people kept on going skiing when they reached their junior year. I still have friends who tell me that, you know, that ski trip was super fun. So I think that's one of the more precious memories I have from St. Mary's.
At the end of the podcast, I like to ask the guest what is to come in their lives. And I know we've already kind of touched upon that, but, you know, especially you being still senior in college, I would be more interested to ask you, as opposed to what's coming up in the next few years, what do you see happening in the next few decades in your career?
I ask myself that question like every day, right? I wake up to that question. I'm like, what am I doing with my life? Like, what do I see? Where do I see myself in the next 5, 10, 50 years? And honestly, like, I don't think I've been able to gather my thoughts and have a clear cut answer for that. But I do want to eventually, I think, step out of this world of money and finance, eventually, obviously, maybe not in the near term, but in the long term, like eventually step out of this world of money and share sort of these fruits with other people. Like that's sort of my big, big grand goal, right? Is whatever I do and whatever I make of it and make out of, like, you know, really the kind of fruits I make, like I do want to spread that and make sure that, you know, some of that legacy is left within these smaller communities around me. So I don't know what that means, but whether that's being building a foundation, that's what I want to do.
That's cool. So much potential, right? And so many directions you can take. And it's really exciting to hear, you know, you guys, this COVID, I hate to say COVID generation, but I mean, that's basically what it is, right? I was the financial crisis generation. And now you guys, the COVID generation, still, you guys seem to be, you know, holding up. And, you know, with the vaccine coming up, it seems like, you know, things will, you know, make a turnaround. And as you said, some industries have not been hurt. I mean, unless you're seriously in the sports or tourism industry, it seems like, you know, hopefully it goes back to business as usual this fall. But yeah, thank you for being part of this season 7 premiere. So episode 61, second youngest, right? Not the youngest. The youngest is still a class of 2020. So I don't know. I don't know if that's going to be beaten for a while because he literally graduated. Yeah, like seven months ago.
I mean, if there's one thing that I just want to sort of mention last is, you know, obviously this alumni network is precious, and St. Mary's as an all-boys school has definitely been able to keep a tight-knit community, and people have, like myself, benefited from it, right? But I think it definitely is important for like our alumni network, for other alumni networks to kind of expand and connect with each other, whether that's with like the all-girls school with Ish. You know, I know that there's a lot of efforts going into them building their own alumni network that are for all women. I would love, if you ever have the chance to speak with some of the people that are in charge of spread this woman empowerment initiative, I'd love for you to speak to them, because I think there's something going for them. And I think that's a project that has potential. I think it's really important that Japan, especially after a bit of news, recently with sexist remarks and stuff, that we make sure that, you know, these women feel they have a place. And so if you ever have the opportunity and the time, if you could ever sometime interview them, that'd be great.
Definitely. And I agree with you with the whole horizontal networking. It is definitely, I think, the next big step for us, you know, quote unquote, INTA kids, is sort of almost have what you guys have at St. Mary's, but start to evolve into that web, right? ASIJ and YS and St. Moore. Because, you know, what's pretty cool is, and you'll probably feel this too as you join the workforce, and I felt it too myself, is when you go to the international school, sure, you're closer with someone from the same school, but you're still like very much sort of in the loop. You know what I mean? If someone's went to another international school, it's like, okay, you know, you're one of us, you know? And it's definitely it's a great feeling to sort of have that extended family. But yeah, thank you again, Tokyo, for being on.
Thank you for doing this. It's been a pleasure.
Same here. And I'll see you around.
Yeah, thank you.